Stories of Great Christians. From the Department of Broadcasting of the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago, we bring you Chapter 1 of Mover of Men and Mountains, the story of Robert Gilmore Letourneau. I understand we're going to be visiting together for the next few days. I'm R.G. Letourneau. I'm responsible for a lot of that road-building equipment you've seen around the country, those yellow scrapers and rooters and bulldozers. If the name Letourneau sounds familiar, maybe that's where you saw it. I'm kind of nervous about all this. The Lord has allowed me to speak to lots of people over these past years, but I've never was much for public speaking. I'm the sort of fellow who feels that if a thing goes without saying, let it. Yep, I'm just a mechanic whom the Lord has blessed. I was born in Vermont in 1888. The old-timers allowed it was the worst winter they could ever remember, which is probably the reason my father went south and west after I was born, looking for sunshine and more pleasant place to live. We were a family of eight, five boys and three girls. I was model number five. I may have been the straw that broke the camel's back. At any rate, my dad packed my mother and all of us kids and shipped us off to her parents, while he and Robert Gilmore looked for the sunshine. Robert Gilmore was his best friend. I was named for him. And my mother didn't see my father or Mr. Gilmore until 2 years later, in 1890, when all of us were reunited in Duluth. Duluth, Minnesota. That's where you say you have 9 months of winter and 3 months of tough sledding.
The coffee is good, Elizabeth. And hot.
Caleb, I'm sure I'll never fully understand you.
Elizabeth, I went searching for a better home. And isn't this a fine house? Built it myself. A man can take pride in what he does with his hands. Besides, I'm a contractor now.
And you've been restless ever since. You have a responsibility to your family,
yes,
too.
Yes, yes, I know. You're right. I have been restless. I'll do better now. This will be a good place to live. You'll see. Oh, may I have another cup of coffee? Something to fight the chill.
Oh.
My father's full name was Caleb Thucydides Letourneau. How's that for a moniker? And his father had wanted him to become a preacher. Grandfather had been a preacher himself. He was a Huguenot who left Lyon, France, to serve as a missionary in Quebec. Because of illness, he later emigrated from Canada to Vermont. There were preachers on my mother's side, too, Scottish Presbyterians, the Lorimers and the Martins. But while we're on the subject of church, I might as well mention that our family attended a fellowship of the Plymouth Brethren. Much later in my life, I would join the Christian and Missionary Alliance. But I'm way ahead of my story. I guess you might say I was something of a problem child. Maybe I took after my dad. I sure was as restless as he was, and he and I didn't get along too well.
Bob, what in the world are you doing climbing up that stack of shingles?
I'm exploring.
Someday you'll become another David Livingstone. How about doing some work around here? Like chopping some wood for the stove. I'll be back in a bit to see how you're doing. Bob? Bob, do you hear me?
Yeah, Dad.
What are you chopping? Bob, these aren't the logs for firewood. These are my new fence posts.
They sure chop easy.
Forget the chopping. Go haul some water to the kitchen.
It's not my turn.
Well, whose turn is it?
It's Bill's turn. I keep count.
You keep count. Well, it's a pity you can't count that well in school. Now, get busy on drawing the water.
It's not fair, Dad.
Get the water.
Caleb, I can't finish cooking supper until I have more water.
Well, Bob brought it in, didn't he?
No one has brought me any water all day.
Bob!
Yes, Dad?
Didn't I tell you to bring in the water?
Yes, sir, you did.
Well, your mother says it hasn't arrived from the well.
Yes, sir.
What do you mean, yes, sir?
The well is dry, Dad.
Dry? That's a spring-fed well. It's never been dry. Holds at least 12 barrels of water.
Have a look, Dad. It's dry.
Well, I don't believe it.
Caleb, if Bob says it's dry, it's dry. Bob does a lot of things, but he doesn't lie.
And I am going to have a look.
Dad had his look, and I hadn't lied. The well was dry. Granted, it was a rather strange happenstance. then, the next morning at breakfast...
Funny thing about that well this morning, Bob.
What do you mean, sir?
I mean it's full, right up to where the water usually tops off. Filled up during the night, Bob.
That's funny.
Funny. Bob, I know what happened.
Sir?
We have a very moist garden now behind the barn. It hasn't rained for a week. Bob, you empty that well.
Dad, I...
Don't lie. Your mother's right about one thing. You do a lot of things, but you don't lie. Don't start now.
Yes, sir. Why are you laughing, Dad?
The way you get out of work. instead of carrying four buckets of water to your mother in the kitchen, you must have spent 4 hours carrying 12 barrels of water from the well to the garden back of the barn. Oh, Bob, I don't know what we're going to do with you.
I was a mess, giving myself the best marks. You might say I was inquisitive, energetic, and determined. But I was sure destructive at times, and stubborn as a mule. I took over the paper route from my two older brothers, Harold and Bill. They'd kept it going for 3 years without a complaint. I lost it in 8 months through daydreaming, throwing papers to the wrong houses, or not throwing them at all. My father wanted me to keep busy, so he said he'd pay me a quarter of a cent for every stick of wood I'd split, which had been my pay for throwing each newspaper. I liked the idea, and I chopped up a storm. I was able to buy a .22 rifle, and just about broke my dad, even though he kept his side of the bargain. About that time, I built my first piece of earth-moving equipment. Well, really, it was a kind of a snowplow. I figured it'd save me some time doing a chore I didn't much enjoy. And I hitched the contraption to a heifer. I never did find out if it would have worked, since the heifer kicked my invention to smithereens. And then there was that time that I dove into Lake Superior. I was showing off. And I saw the rock I was going to hit as I was diving. Water in Lake Superior is 50 degrees when it's warm. Maybe that shock kept me alive. It took 16 stitches to sew up my head. I hadn't been doing too well in school, as you may have gathered. However, in the fifth grade, I learned how to read. Let me explain that. I discovered, there in the fifth grade, that reading was more than words. I discovered that there were sentences and paragraphs. And I really made up for lost time. My teacher couldn't believe the progress I made. Then she had to go and promote me to the seventh grade, letting me skip sixth grade. That was a mistake. I wasn't that good a student, and I sure couldn't keep up with seventh grade work. So I took another kind of dive. My grades slipped downward. I was unhappy. My parents were unhappy. I decided the time had come for me to leave home. I was 13 years old. I didn't travel far, but I camped out and thought the woods were full of wolves. Next morning, I was hungry, naturally, but I wasn't about to head back home. Instead, I realized I was only about a mile away from Mrs. Spagmo's house. Now, she was a widow lady, a Swedish, and I had done chores for her from time to time. I figured that she'd give me some breakfast.
These sure are good pancakes, Mrs. Spagmo.
Would you like some more, Bob?
No, ma'am. I'm full up to here. I'll go milk your cow to pay for my breakfast.
You're running away from home, aren't you? Oh, I'm a pretty good guesser. Where would you be going?
To Two Harbors. I figure I can get a job as a cabin boy on one of the oar boats.
How would you like to earn a dollar before you go?
A whole dollar? Sure.
I've got to go to town. You can hitch my horse, feed the chickens, and dig up my potatoes.
Sure thing, Mrs. Spagmo.
Mrs. Spagmo took a long time going and coming. I now know that she stopped by to talk to my folks. They finally agreed it might be best for me to work as a hired hand for a while in somebody else's household. And Mrs. Spagmo sure laid down the law.
There were no dumb Swedes in my family. And I won't have one now, even if he does have a French name.
I worked harder than I had ever worked before. My day was scheduled from morning to night, and of course I still had to go to school. The difference being, I now had further to walk. Still, I was getting paid for my work, and it seemed like a pretty good arrangement. Except that I was lonely, and missed my family. I got to see them at Thanksgiving at my Uncle Emmanuel's house when the blizzard set in. My dad left to take care of his stock, and I volunteered to walk with him. This plowing through snow on foot was rough going and dangerous in a way. We'd each fallen down, slip as we tried to get up, and laugh as though this were the funniest thing we'd ever seen.
I've got to go on to Mrs. Spagmo's, Dad.
It's another milestone, and I think she's probably taking care of her stock by now.
Probably.
So why don't you stop here? There'll be only the two of us.
Can I help you with the stock, Dad?
Sure, if you want to. I brought in some firewood. Over here, Bob.
I remember where to put it.
Here's some hot milk, and I'm making pancakes, and some bacon.
I never knew my dad was such a good cook. In fact, suddenly, I was learning lots of new things about him.
Maybe my chopping the wood will pay for my breakfast.
Oh, no, no need for you to pay for anything, Bob. You know that. Son, it's just nice to see you here at our table.
Dad, I'm sorry. Running away wasn't right.
No, don't say another word. I know what you've been going through, and... Well, I've been going through it myself, so... We've been wrong, both of us. Now eat hearty.
That was quite a lesson, and I haven't forgotten it. Discovering my father's love changed my whole attitude. The chores I'd hated and fought against, I now did cheerfully, because I wanted to serve him. It's like that, only more so when you discover the Lord. If you aren't serving him now, it's because you don't know him. Like I didn't really know my own father. But when you do know him, you'll love him. And when you love him, you'll serve him. And find the greatest happiness in doing so that you will ever know. And so we conclude Chapter 1 of Mover of Men and Mountains, the story of R.G. Letourneau. This is another in the series of Stories of Great Christians, produced by the Department of Broadcasting of the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago. Stories of Great Christians. From the Department of Broadcasting of the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago, we bring you Chapter 2 of Mover of Men and Mountains, the story of Robert Gilmore Letourneau. Yep, I was a restless kid, all right. And I gave my parents fits. I remember my mother saying...
Bobby, if you'll sit down in that chair and keep still for 5 minutes, I'll give you 5 cents.
Which sounded like a pretty fair deal. And after 5 minutes, I said...
I'll sit still for 5 minutes more for another nickel.
We moved from Duluth, Minnesota to Portland, Oregon in 1902. I was 14. Harold, my oldest brother, was 19 and stayed on to attend the University of Minnesota. We moved mostly on account of Mr. Walker, one of the Plymouth Brethren my dad had known, who had moved earlier to the Pacific Northwest and sent back glowing accounts of fortunes to be made in the construction business. My father and I had made our peace, more or less.
Well, Bob, school starts next Monday. We made our move in time for all you kids to enroll here in Portland.
I ain't a-going.
You what?
I ain't a-going back to school.
You're not.
I'm not going back to school.
Why? You haven't finished the eighth grade.
I'm a man-growed, Pop. That's why.
You're a man-growed.
Yes, sir.
You're only 14 years old.
And I'm 6 feet tall, and I weigh 160 pounds. I reckon it's time I went to work.
Well, we don't have to decide everything tonight. Let's pray about it and sleep on it.
Knowing that my folks were praying for me didn't really make me feel all that comfortable. Next Sunday, I noticed my dad talking to Mr. Hill after church. Mr. Hill was an Englishman and he owned a foundry in Portland. Normally, my dad didn't discuss business on Sunday, but the way things turned out, I guess there was just a little bit of a Sabbath negotiation.
Come on, Bob. Time to get up.
It can't be. It's dark outside. What time is it?
5:30.
5:30?
Come on now. As long as you're a grown man, you have to be to work at 6:30. Surely you don't want to be late on your first day.
What are you talking about, Dad?
I got breakfast started. Now get moving. Well, you're going to learn the iron business with Mr. Hill. You'll be an apprentice molder.
An apprentice molder?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Hill's been having some trouble out at his ironworks. What with his apprentices complaining about all that hard work and quitting before noon, I told him he wouldn't have that kind of trouble with you, seeing you're a man grown.
I didn't know what an iron molder was, but that little dig from my dad sure motivated me to get going and keep going. It was no playground I was going to. I owned my own steel mill, and I still find something mighty impressive about molten metal. I've already mentioned that Mr. Hill was British.
Good day, Robert.
Also, he was a gentleman. Here's how you could tell. He wore a beard, you see, a long beard. And although no one would have known it, he always wore a shirt and tie.
Well, Robert, here's a job we have for you. As they say, it's a job for a strong back and a weak mind. Little bit of a joke there, don't you? Well, at any rate, there's a gondola full of sand out in the yard. Just shovel the sand into the wheelbarrow and bring it in here. Joe will show you where to dump it.
I hadn't wheeled 10 wheelbarrows of that stuff that had soaked up about 2 weeks of Portland's rain before I was hunting for an easier way of moving dirt. Furthermore, I'd achieved an enormous respect for 1 cubic yard of sand.
Joe, I've hauled 10 loads, and there's not even a dent in that carload of sand.
Bob, you're always complaining.
I am not. I work hard.
You got the easiest job in the foundry.
Just how do you figure that?
Well, look. Yeah. Pushing is a rest from shoveling. Shoveling is a rest from pushing. And then there's the trip back with an empty barrel where you don't do anything at all. Why, kid, you got yourself a job that's just one long rest.
A humorous man, that Joe. And strong, too, like most foundrymen. Yeah, my lessons continued. Mixing sand, clay, and water for a mold.
I don't want you to work too hard, son.
Yes, Mr. Hill?
I just want you to work fast.
One day, I put too much water in the sand. And the pour exploded all the way to the roof of the foundry.
Now look what you did, Letourneau!
Well, that isn't exactly what he said. I've had my ears pinned back with words that leave me grateful I have any ears left. Eventually, I got to spend some time in the machine shop. An old German craftsman talked me into building a miniature steam engine, or trying to build one.
You work with brass, copper, nickel. You work with gray iron, white iron, and steel. You make something. And when it is finished, you know how to work metal. And you know how to work steam engines. Joe, may I see you a minute?
Yes, Mr. Hill? What is it?
Is the Letourneau boy working out well?
Oh, he's a good worker, and he spends most of his lunch hours with Fritz in the machine shop, on his own time.
I'm not sure I like some of the people he's running around with.
Oh, they're just boys, sir. We do have a few wild apprentices.
I have a special responsibility for him. I want to pass the word around. I don't want any man offering the other side of his bucket of suds to that 15-year-old.
Yes, sir.
Any man who does that is asking for trouble. Probably dismissal.
Yes, sir. I understand, sir.
I guess in that sense I did have a sheltered life. But Mr. Hill couldn't protect me all the time. I was curious and adventurous. And I spent more time than I should have with my buddies, watching the tough lumberjacks celebrate along our skid row. Incidentally, that's an old lumbering term. We had a skid road in Portland, over which logs were skidded or dragged by horses or oxen and pushed into the Willamette River. But eventually, booze transformed Skid Road to Skid Row. Compliments of Portland, Oregon.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm coming. Yes, officer. What is it?
You're Bob Letourneau?
Yes.
We're looking for Wally.
Wally?
You know who we mean. You're a friend of his.
We've gone to ball games together, that's all.
Where can we find him, Bob?
I don't know. He wasn't at work today.
We know.
What do you want him for?
Assault and battery. Now, if you remember anything, let us know.
I will. Yes, sir. Dad?
Hello, Bob.
You heard?
Yes, I heard. Bob, I won't lecture you, but I think you have a lot to think about. I just hope your mother hasn't been awakened by all this commotion.
I did have a lot to think about, and I decided to attend some revival meetings. It was just before Christmas in 1904. I attended all week. Nothing happened. In fact, I begrudged the time I was spending away from that miniature steam engine I was still trying to build. I said as much to my mother when she asked me if I was enjoying the meetings. I had the good sense to realize I really hurt her with my callous answer. That night, I went to my room and I just poured out my heart to God. I gave myself a working over. No bolt of lightning hit me. I just prayed that God would save me. And then I was aware of another presence. No words were spoken. I received no messages. But my bitterness was gone, drained away. You see, before I was saved, I was churched and Bibleized, but I'd never experienced salvation. I had to tell my folks.
Hey, it's happened. I'm saved. You don't have to worry about me anymore.
Oh, Robert, we knew it had to happen 2 years ago when we discovered we couldn't guide you.
When you said you were a man grown.
We knew God would guide you. We left it in his hands ever since, praying every night that he would help you. Oh, but Robert, he sure kept us waiting a long time.
I joined the church, the Young People Missionary Society, and the choir. I'm not sure why I joined the choir, and I'm also sure that feeling was shared by others. And I kept working on my steam engine. Fritz thought I would never finish it.
Ravi, better a poor steam engine that runs than a good one never finished.
Another bit of good advice. except that today I'd add a line to it. Better a poor steam engine that works than a good one never finished. Because until the good one is finished, its development can't begin. But that's some philosophy for the future.
Bob, sit down.
Yes, sir.
I got this letter today from Tim Goth. Remember him?
From the church?
Yes. He moved to San Francisco.
Caleb, I'm still not sure you should do this.
Tim heard about Mr. Hill's foundry burning up, and he wanted Bob to know that there's work out in San Francisco.
There is? Work?
At a foundry.
Oh, Caleb.
Would you let me go, Dad?
Well, you've never been that far from home on your own, Bob.
Your mother's right.
And you hear such terrible things about San Francisco.
But God's on my side, Mother. You don't need to worry.
Well, perhaps you'll have to learn that it's the other way around. That you want to be sure you are on God's side.
Despite their fears, my parents let me go. San Francisco was a wild place, Barbary Coast and all, but I survived. I met a good Christian family, got a job at the foundry. I even went back to school for a time, attending a vocational school, discovered that I liked it, and I had a nice room at Fifth and Mission. It was the year 1906. The day was April 18th, the day of the earthquake. I was asleep when it began, and at the first tremor, I thought I was back in Duluth, being shaken awake to deliver the morning papers. With a second shockwave, I was in the middle of it. My bed and my dresser swapped places. I thought, this is the end of the world. Thank God I'm saved and going to heaven. And then there was a weird, strange stillness. Not total silence, because buildings were still twisting and falling. But the earth had stopped moving. The floor of my room was tilted, and when I looked out my window, I saw my building and the building which had stood across the alley now leaning against each other. I thanked God for sparing my life and began packing my canvas bag. I wanted to find my friends, and I had the good sense to know that I wouldn't be using that room that night. It was time to move. I climbed onto the street from what had been my second-story window. The fire wagons flew past, and then the wagons filled with bodies, searching for hospitals which no longer stood. And, of course, the foundry where I had worked was a total loss. I keep a motto on my desk today that says, Jesus never fails. I've faced several crises in my life, and I found that little motto to be absolutely true. It was true for me back in San Francisco, true for my friends also, even though we were without homes and jobs. Jesus never fails. So trust the Lord and do your best. And so we conclude Chapter 2 of Mover of Men and Mountains, the story of R.G. Letourneau. This is another in the series, Stories of Great Christians, produced by the Department of Broadcasting of the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago. Stories of Great Christians. From the Department of Broadcasting of the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago, we bring you Chapter 3 of Mover of Men and Mountains, the story of Robert Gilmore Letourneau. Quite a few of us survived the earthquake of 1906 in San Francisco, the fiery Holocaust that followed. All I could do was thank the Lord for his gracious care and love. I was 18, Without my family, they were still up in Oregon, and without a job. The foundry I'd worked for had burned to the ground in the firestorm that followed the earthquake. Come to think of it, that was the second foundry I'd worked for that had burned. Well, I did find work for a time at another ironworks that hadn't been damaged, and although it didn't burn down to the ground, I was let go because there just wasn't enough work to be done. You'd think construction work would have really been booming in San Francisco, but it wasn't. I got another job in a factory making elevators across the bay in Oakland. But again, nobody seemed to be building anything, so they sure didn't need elevators. So, yours truly was looking for work again. I was now a full-fledged member of the Iron Workers Union. No more apprenticeship for me, but that didn't seem to make any difference. Then the panic of 1907 hit the West Coast so hard that the banks closed without bothering to ask if they had been hurt. Things were so bad, I heard they were making misfortune cookies in San Francisco's Chinatown. I walked the streets for days. You couldn't buy a job, even if you could have gotten your money out of a bank to buy it with. That's when I got a letter from my brother Bill.
Bill's the kind of boy that'll go out in the morning with a jackknife and come back for supper on a bicycle.
That's what my dad thought of Bill. I guess you could call him an entrepreneur. Anyway, Bill got me to come out to some land that he had bought near the town of Rex in Oregon.
Looks pretty good, doesn't it, Bob?
Well, if you like cut over land, it's nice, I guess. You sure got a lot of stumps here.
Which is what I want you to pull out. That's what I'll pay you for. Won't be much, but will be a job.
How much land do you have here?
Full section.
And I guess I'm on my own. The lumberman left that lone tree over there, which I guess I'm supposed to use as a spar. You are paying cash. I found a quarry that was closing down and bought a few drums of cable, some pulleys, and an old steam-powered engine known thereabouts as a donkey engine. A burro engine would have been more like it. Anyway, I used that lone tree as a spar, attaching my pulleys there, and began pulling up those stumps. I tried all sorts of tricks, rigging up a network of cable that did real fine until the cable snapped, knocking out half of my front teeth and wrapping itself around me like a panting snake. My dental bill just about equaled what I'd made on that job. But I did learn something. I learned it wasn't smart to work in the wilderness by yourself. A man, when he's doing dangerous work, ought to have a partner. I next worked for the Yerba Buena Power System, where we had to clean huge lead batteries to provide the direct current that the streetcars required. And I learned about welding in the process. Became a bricklayer, a bridge builder. Helped my dad and Uncle Joshua Jehoshaphat clear some land, too. Chopping trees this time. I made enough money to buy my first motorcycle. And I had 100 cords left over. I was into so many things, but here I was, 21 years old, wondering who I was and what I really wanted to make out of my life.
What are you doing, son?
I'm going to send off for some information about a correspondence school.
You plan to go back to school?
No, this kind of school you carry with you. You get the lessons by mail.
Then, well, what do you want to study?
Automobile mechanics, I think. Maybe that way I'll be able to keep my motorcycle running. And so it was that one day I found myself in Stockton, California. No special reason for that, I guess. Except that I believe the Lord had a hand in leading me there. I'd been working on this bridge spanning the Stanislaus River. The bridge was finished, and I crossed it to have supper in Stockton. I debated heading back to Oakland at night over a dirt road, and I suddenly decided I wasn't in any hurry. I was out of a job again, so why not spend the night in Stockton?
Bob! Laterno! Bob Laterno! Oh,
well, I'll be if it isn't old man Jensen. I haven't seen you in 2 or 3 years.
Not since the foundry days in San Francisco.
Hey, what are you doing here?
Me and Cap here. We got us a garage. Cap and my partner here.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, we're mechanics.
Well, Now, if that isn't a coincidence, so am I.
Well, you're pretty young to be an automobile mechanic.
Well, I've taken 4 correspondence courses in auto mechanics.
Is that all you know? What about your experience? I sort of get the idea you might be looking for work.
Now, I can take a motorcycle apart and put it together in a day.
Well, we don't handle motorcycles.
Are you looking for a job, Bob?
Sure am.
Well, he was a good worker when I knew him, Cap.
Well,
we could use a night man. Somebody to answer the phone, clean up the place, wash and polish cars, tow in the stalled cars. You wouldn't exactly be a mechanic.
What's your name again?
Robert Letourneau.
You really want the job?
Yes, sir.
All right. You can have it.
Thanks. I just don't know what else to say. And so a new career began. Mostly, I rescued customers whose cars had broken down. I worked nights and spent much of the day watching and learning from the 2 mechanics. Fortunately, I didn't need too much sleep. Of course, if a clutch had to be removed or a new transmission installed, old Bob here came in handy. Yes, sir.
You're the mechanic?
I'm the man you called, yes.
Yeah, get to work on it. I've got house calls to make.
Left-handed Cadillac.
I've been calling it some other things. Why left-handed?
Because you crank them up backwards.
I don't know that from personal experience, and I've put casts on plenty of crank-handle brakes. Well, when are you going to get started?
Well, I only came to tow your car, Doctor.
Tow it? I want it fixed.
Well, I'm only the night man. I'm not supposed to work on expensive cars.
Why did they send you?
Nobody else, I guess.
I paid a lot of money for this car, and I don't want any second-rate mechanic wrecking it for me. You think you can fix it?
Well, it depends.
I've already taken out the spark plugs and put them back.
Well, let me check your carburetor. I can clean them pretty good. There's lots of rust in our gasoline around here. Plugs up the needle valve. Well, let's give her a turn or two, Doctor.
Okay.
Why don't you advance the spark for me?
All right.
Well, I did it.
It sure did. But, young man, you know your stuff.
Bob, you sure made a hit with a doctor.
And now he insists on only you working on his car.
And he's sending some of his friends over to our place now.
So I guess we just better promote your daytime mechanic.
Oh, thanks, Cap. You too, Mr. Jensen. I'll just try that out for a while. Hi, Parks. Why aren't you at work?
You know, Bob, you and me ought to be partners.
Well, I don't know, Parks. It doesn't seem fair to Cap'n Jensen.
Sure took him a long time to realize how good you were. Hey, besides, you know, my dad says there's room in Stockton for another garage.
Well, that much is true.
Yeah, we could do it, Bob. You know, you're the mechanic.
Oh, you're the salesman, that's for sure.
All we need to get the Regal franchise is $2,000. I got my $1,000.
I've still got 100 cords of wood to sell up in the hills. They ought to be worth $10 a cord.
There's your $1,000.
That Regal's a real road scorcher.
It'll sell better than the Saxon or the White Streak.
All we need to do is engender a little excitement, showing everybody what the Regal can do. Maybe at the county fair.
I got a name for our garage. Superior Garage. Now, how's that for size?
Might as well start at the top. How about a location?
Right on Main Street, near the corner of Information, Education, Salvation, and Damnation.
What?
Well, there's the Telephone Exchange. That's Information. The Business College is Education, and the YMCA is Salvation.
And the town jail is Damnation. Yeah. Parks, you're really something. And you've got yourself a partner. There. That'll do it.
You're really going to drive up that stairway?
That's what I promised the fairground officials. 30 feet up, 30 feet down, not an inch to spare on either side. That ought to sell a few Regals, don't you think? No other dealer will match us.
No other dealer has the nerve. Bob, what'll you do for an encore?
Huh?
Well, what'll you do at the fair next year?
Oh, one fair at a time, all right? We'll think of something when the time comes.
Okay.
Next year, in 1912, we entered a regal with the regular racers. Racing a stock car was something new in those days. We also imported a driver with the unlikely name of Percy Arthur. Percy thought I ought to be able to put a bit more fire in that engine. So I opened the apertures and the carburetor, added some fancy new spark plugs and an air scoop, and changed the worn-out tires. We really moved around that track, trying her out before the big race. The only trouble was, the Regal wouldn't corner. At least not the way Percy was accustomed to driving. Hey, Percy! Watch that outside fence! What are those curtains doing fluttering around? I don't have any curtains in my room.
You're in a hospital, Mr. Letourneau.
And you're a nurse.
That's right. Now, you're not to move around. And I'm to tell the doctor that you're awake.
I think I remember now. What happened?
Your car crashed.
What happened to Percy, to the driver?
He's fine.
Fine?
He was unconscious, but no broken bones.
And me?
Well, that's why you must lie still. You have a broken neck.
I learned later that Percy was still steering for the next lap when they pulled him out of the wreckage. At first, the ambulance crew thought I was dead. And in those days, before doctors knew much about traction or padded collars, a broken neck was serious business. I'm telling you all this to make this point. I guess I was what you'd call an accident-prone individual. Since I was a young boy, when I dove on that rock in Lake Superior, wrapped myself with that cable, pulling out those stumps, you remember? I haven't bothered to tell you how I put an axe into my leg chopping wood, or the spittles I took on my motorcycle. I took chances. I had very little fear, and it was silly. I don't think I led a charmed life like some folks allowed, but God certainly watched over me in ways that were simply marvelous. And he spared me to grow up emotionally and get a little more sense, be the man he intended me to be. But for a while, in fact for a good many months, I had a very sore and painful neck to remind me that I'd better learn to take it easy and trust the Lord. And so we conclude Chapter 3 of Mover of Men and Mountains, the story of R.G. Letourneau. This is another in the series, Stories of Great Christians, produced by the Department of Broadcasting of the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago. Stories of Great Christians. From the Department of Broadcasting of the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago, we bring you Chapter 4 of Mover of Men and Mountains, the story of Robert Gilmore Letourneau. Some of you hearing this story may have heard me speak somewhere, perhaps at your church or at a Bible conference. If you remember how I looked, you may remember that my head sort of turned to one side. My wife thought it made me look attentive. Well, that attentive look was due to a broken neck I acquired in that automobile accident back in 1912. The doctors in those days couldn't do very much to help. For a while, My head rested so heavily on my shoulder that my ear was being rubbed raw. Percy Arthur, the racing champion who had been driving while I rode along as his mechanic, joked that maybe we should rerun the race in the other direction, wrecking the car again on the other side and maybe break my neck back into place. It took months of massage and muscle training before I could really hold my head up. You can be sure that when I did succeed, it was through the help of God. Hey, a moment ago I mentioned my wife, didn't I? Let me tell you about Evelyn. I'd been out to Oscar Peterson's place doing him a sort of favor.
Bob, I sure appreciate your coming by again tonight.
Glad to, Oscar.
I wish those Teamsters would lay off of me. Just because I want to buy a truck to haul furniture, it won't put the Teamsters and their teams out of business.
One day the Teamsters will be driving trucks instead of horses just like you.
You think so?
Oh, wait and see.
Papa? Papa, are you talking to Uncle Bob?
Oh, it sounds like your daughter.
Evelyn, it's late.
Hello, Uncle Bob.
Hello, Evelyn.
Uncle Bob, when your head tilts over like that, do you see things sideways or like I do?
Evelyn.
I see things upside down.
Ha. Oh, you're joshing me.
And so do you.
I don't believe you.
Your eye is like a camera, Evelyn. What you see is upside down. I'll explain it to you sometime.
Maybe that's why you're so mixed up sometimes. Upside down.
Oh, Papa.
Now, back to the house. It's late.
All right. Good night, Uncle Bob.
Good night.
Papa?
I'm sorry she pesters you so.
Oh, I'm getting used to it, Oscar. I make allowances. She's only 12, you know.
I've been meaning to bring this up. And maybe this isn't the right time, but Bob, the wife and I have been talking, and we have this vacant room out here, and we wondered if you'd like to rent it. You've been kind of standing guard out here with me so often, you might as well live here. That is, if you can stand Evelyn and her questions.
Oh, of course I can. You're really serious.
Yes, sir.
Well, it sure would be nicer than living in that back room of the garage. All right. You tell Mrs. Peterson that I'll take you up on that offer. I'll take the room. Life with the Petersons was never dull. All seven of them. And I rediscovered what being with a family was like. I learned how to eat with a fork again. And how to drink coffee out of a cup instead of a saucer. As my neck healed and my head began to stand straighter on my shoulders, I was able to look around with new interest.
Uncle Bob, are you going out on a date tonight?
Yes, I am, Evelyn.
Here, let me straighten your tie.
Oh, it's all right.
Well, you hardly ever wear a tie. Let me fix it.
Well, thank you, Evelyn.
Is she nice, your date?
I guess so.
Have a nice time, Uncle Bob.
Evelyn ran off crying, and I wasn't quite sure why. But even a thick skull like me finally realized one day that Evelyn wasn't an awkward 12-year-old in gingham dress and high-button shoes anymore, but an attractive young lady who had grown up before my very eyes. And I almost hadn't noticed. Just about this time in my life, my folks moved to Stockton.
Son, it sure is good to be a family again.
Oh, yeah, bought a nice house, Dad.
You are staying to supper.
No, I thought I'd drive up to the Petersons.
You're sure seeing a lot of that little girl, aren't you?
Now, don't go getting ideas or wrong impressions, Dad. She's just my little pal.
I hear tell you go driving together a lot.
I guess my dad was suggesting that I did more road testing than most mechanics found necessary. And once he had planted the idea in my mind, I discovered how right he was.
Bob, I'm glad you leveled with me about how you feel about Evelyn. I think you're a fine fellow, Bob, and I don't object to your marrying Evelyn if you want to wait for her.
I'm sorry you're so cold, Evelyn. I wish you'd brought a coat.
There wasn't time, Bob, and Dad would have been suspicious.
Well, use that lap robe. These Saxons are great little cars, but they're just one big air scoop.
How far are we from the border?
We're past San Diego. We'll soon be in Tijuana. I'm sorry, Evelyn. I'm sure this isn't the way you dreamed of being married.
Oh, that doesn't matter now, Bob. We've made our decision, and we're going to build our life together.
Oh, I love you, young lady. And nobody better give me any trouble about your being 16.
I'm going to be 17 in just a few weeks.
Now that makes a difference. Except to California law.
Oh, Bob, cheer up. I don't believe the Lord is unhappy with us. And it's our wedding day.
I'm not promoting elopement, certainly not to any young couple in love. I wish I had Oscar Peterson's permission, especially the way things turned out. But Evelyn and I were in love, and we both loved the Lord, and we felt then that we had to do what we did. But we were in serious trouble. Mr. Peterson went to the police and said I had kidnapped his daughter, and I returned to Stockton as soon as I heard about the charge. And the district attorney was most unhappy with me. He didn't look kindly upon my marrying a California girl under 18 in Mexico. But he was an honest man, and he soon saw that I certainly hadn't kidnapped her. Finally, he said, "All right, Bob, we're dropping the charges, but so help me, don't do it again." Which was sort of comical under the circumstances, except that I lost a friend in Oscar Peterson who vowed that he would never speak to me again. World War I was on. Since I've got to admit I'm no pacifist where I think wrong is being done, I tried to enlist in the Navy, but was turned down because of that neck injury. Instead, I got a job at the Mare Island Navy Yard. I became an electrical machinist, winding coils, machining rotors, installing generators, all parts of building ships. I still had my partnership in the Stockton garage. Excuse me, the Superior garage. But it was a silent partnership, and not much money was coming in. It wasn't easy for Evelyn.
Bob, I've worked hard since I was 10. I've sewn my own clothes since I was 14. I can manage.
And she managed to give me a son on October 30th, 1918. We named him Caleb, after my father. Armistice Day, you remember, I hope you remember, was November 11th.
Bob? Bob, you're back from the wars. Well, I suppose you're back for good, huh?
Well, I hope so, Parks. I hope so. Well, how are you?
Fine.
And the business?
Oh, it's it's not so fine. It's we didn't really have much to sell during the war, and you weren't really here to repair the old cars.
How long has this been going on?
what do you mean?
Well, they told me at the bank that things were in bad shape. I'd like to know how bad.
You're just going to have to figure them out for yourself, Bob, because the bills and the stubs are all in that drawer over there. Just go out and help yourself. I'm just the salesman, remember?
Things were bad, and they would get worse. Parks had played the small-town big shot, over-entertaining and over-drinking, and had literally gone through a $40,000 business. I thought we could get back some of the money by repairing the used cars he had taken in trade, until I learned that he had borrowed more on each car than we could possibly sell them for. I was so furious with the man that I couldn't think straight. And then there was another blow. There was a terrible flu epidemic in 1919. We lived on a street that backed up to St. Joseph's Hospital. And each day we saw the victims being carried in and carried out. On February 9, 1919, our son Caleb died. He wasn't even 4 months old.
Oh, Bob.
There, girl.
What were we do?
We'll trust God, Evelyn. He's been speaking to me. Evelyn, the Lord's been telling me that I've been working hard, but for the wrong things. And he's given me a verse, and I'm going to make it my life verse. Matthew 6:33. But seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you.
In spite of the hurt and the worry, it made a difference. First, we found a new fellowship with Christian friends in the Christian and Missionary Alliance. Then, perhaps the biggest difference of all, my feelings toward Parks were changed.
Gentlemen, are you ready to proceed?
Bob, are you sure this is what you want to do?
Yes, I am. I asked for this meeting with you gentlemen from the bank because I think the time has come to try to straighten out this mess.
You've been making some progress, Mr. Letourneau.
Yes, we're only $20,000 in debt now. The best I can figure it, with all the repairing I'm doing, I'm getting back about 60 cents on the dollar. I can't keep that up. So I'd like to withdraw from the partnership. I'm not trying to get out of my share of the debts.
Please explain.
The garage is on its feet again. It'll pay its way in another year or two. Now, I've got a half interest that ought to be worth something. I want to sell that half interest, apply that on my debts, and then pay the balance if it takes me the rest of my life.
So there I was, 30 years old, unemployed, $5,000 in debt. Not very promising, was it? But you know, I felt pretty good about it. Until my sister Sarah came to visit. Sarah had become a missionary to China.
What's the matter with you, Bob? Don't you love our Savior? When you love him, you'll want to serve him. You'll hunt for ways to do it.
I was all mixed up. I wanted to put God's kingdom first. I wanted to serve the Lord. Did that mean I had to become a missionary like Sarah? Or a preacher like Pastor Duvall? I just didn't know. And so we conclude Chapter 4 of Mover of Men and Mountains, the story of R.G. Letourneau. This is another in the series, Stories of Great Christians, produced by the Department of Broadcasting of the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago. Stories of Great Christians. From the Department of Broadcasting of the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago, we bring you Chapter 5 of Mover of Men and Mountains, the story of Robert Gilmore Letourneau. My sister Sarah, my sister who had gone to China to be a missionary and was home on furlough, really laid it on the line.
You've done lots of good deeds, Bob, but that's not loving Jesus. When you love him, you'll want to serve him. You'll hunt for ways to do it.
I thought I was a pretty good member of the Christian and Missionary Alliance. Evelyn and I had lost our first son, Caleb, in that dreadful influenza epidemic of 1919. And I thought I'd handle my grief as a Christian. Then the Superior Garage went bankrupt, and I thought I controlled my anger against my partner who drank most of the money away, handling it the way Christ would want me to. But I had to admit there was a hunger, a dissatisfaction. And maybe my sister Sarah was right. At any rate, Pastor Duvall of our church held a series of meetings, and I borrowed a car to be there every night. The final night came, and, well, glory flooded my soul.
Come right in, Bob.
You're sure you've got time to see me, Pastor Duvall?
Oh, of course. I was glad to see you this past week.
Pastor, last night meant a whole lot to me. I asked the Lord to forgive me and help me. And I told him that I'd do anything he wanted me to. I've never prayed that kind of prayer before. Even though I asked Christ into my life when I was 16. But I never prayed this way before.
Bob, I'm so glad.
Well, Pastor, I just know the Lord heard me. I felt I really met him there at the altar last night.
Bob, I saw you at the altar. And I felt God's presence, too. But why are you here today?
I guess I'm confused. I want to serve the Lord. And when I got back home last night, after the service, I stood out in the yard looking at some of those rundown machines I have, and I wondered if I were seeing them for the last time.
Are you saying that you think God may be calling you to do something else in life? Do you think he wants you to be a preacher?
No. But maybe I could be a missionary. I enjoy what I do at the Peniel Mission. I can converse with people. Maybe I even have a knack with some of those rough and ready rowdies. From what my sister tells me, they need people on the mission field who know something about construction or keeping pumps and engines going.
Oh, I'm sure there's lots you could do overseas, Bob. You know, Brother Letourneau, God needs businessmen as well as preachers and missionaries.
He does?
Every Christian is called to serve. Full-time Christian service isn't just a matter of being a minister or a missionary. It's doing whatever God calls you to do.
As laymen?
Of course. And the testimony of a layman probably means much more to someone seeking the Lord.
How's that?
Well, a preacher is sort of a paid salesman, while the layman is the satisfied customer.
That's good.
God does need businessmen, Bob. I think he needs you where you are.
All right. If that's what God wants me to be, I'll try to be his businessman.
You know, the trouble with most of us is that we try to fit God into our plans rather than fit ourselves into his plan. Slowly it dawned on me that God and I were in a partnership. I don't say that lightly. Real partners don't try to see how much one can get from the other. They work for the good of the partnership. They try to help each other. In time, when it came to the money I made this decision. Not how much of my money do I give to God, but how much of God's money do I keep for myself? But I'm getting ahead of my story. The day after I gave up the garage business and assumed a $5,000 debt, I met an old friend by the name of Ira Guy. Ira and his brother were in the farm machinery business, and I thought they could use a good mechanic. That's how I got into the earth-moving business. I went out to the farms and ranches where the tractors were stalled, and that's where I fixed them. Then I learned that tractors weren't being used so much in farming as they were in leveling land. Irrigation was the hottest thing going in California in the early 20s. So I hired myself out as a mechanic and tractor driver, finding someone else to handle the primitive scrapers we pulled behind us. By the end of my second day, I knew I'd found a job that satisfied me like no other job in my life. When I was in dry land, the track-type treads threw dust in my face. When I was in the bottoms, they threw mud, and I loved it. I found I had a lot of time to think, too, mostly about how to level more smoothly and haul more dirt more quickly. Some men go for airplanes or electronics or cars, I went for what in those days must have been the ugliest chunk of brute machinery you'd ever want to see. I had found my challenge and my life.
Bob, I think we should talk about finances.
Well, Evelyn, you've got enough to worry about it.
Oh, Bob, please. We're in this together, and I know you're worried about the bank debt.
I'm doing a job I enjoy, but I'm not getting ahead. Not even at $2 an hour, which is pretty fair pay for people today.
I know. That's why I'd like to go to work.
You? No, Evelyn. Earning a living is a job for the man of the house.
Oh, but I found a job that I can do, and that'll help us out. It'll only be for a few weeks, Bob. Please, let me take the job. It'll help some.
It could help a lot, Evelyn. Thank you for wanting to help. I've often said that determination makes up for not being smart. And I was sure determined, especially after my talk with Pastor Duvall and wanting to be God's businessman. Let me describe some of the high finance of those early days. I was able to buy a good used Saxon Roadster for $400, and I had to borrow the money from my sister. When prices went up for both new and used cars, I sold the car for $1,000. I used the extra $600 to buy an old 1915 Holt tractor. I had repaid the bank $1,000 against the $5,000 I owed. And the bank let me borrow back the $1,000 so I'd have some cash in hand, some liquidity, as we businessmen use the term. My friend Ira Guy let me rent an old Schmeisser scraper. And suddenly, I was a contractor, in business for myself. Now, I could charge $7.50 an hour for my time and the use of my equipment. As days got longer, I'd work up to 14 hours a day, sometimes achieving that magic mark of earning $100 a day. Sounds good? Well, let me tell you, I still had to learn a lot. Like, the more you earn, the more you can lose. Like the time I repaired an irrigation pump. I repaired it fine, but I didn't know anything about hydraulics. I didn't know about what's called the inertia of water in pipes. I turned the engine on full speed, and I had to pay for a lot of burst pipe. And I still had to learn that an expert in one field is no expert if one field is all he knows. For instance, there are a lot of angles to hydraulics that have nothing to do with liquids. Cement, for instance. I contracted to build a 4,000-foot water pipeline for Carlton Case. He was the lawyer who helped me settle my debt with the bank. My brother-in-law, Howard Peterson, was helping me on this job.
It sure looks good, Bob. You gonna try it out?
In a minute. It does look good. Straight as an arrow. And this time I read up on concrete pipe.
Do you think we should bury it now?
No. We're going to test it first. We'd be in an awful mess if we had a few leaks and had to dig it up. Let's test her now, okay?
Boy, that sure is one long pipeline.
Nearly a mile. Oh, no. Look, Howard. All along the line, every 2 feet, at every joint.
Bob, we don't have a pipeline. We've got the biggest water sprinkler in the world.
My mistake had been that while the bottom half of my nicely laid pipe lay in the damp, cool soil of the trench, the top half was exposed to the burning California sun. The bottom half cured perfectly, while the top half had shrunk. We made it good, patching and sealing so the pipeline wouldn't leak. But it was a costly mistake.
Bob, the pipeline is in tip-top shape now. I'm sure sorry this happened.
Well, I say all you can do is trust the Lord and do your best, quit worrying, and go to work.
Bob, I have a business proposition to make. I have a house in Stockton I'd like to sell you.
Oh, I can't buy anything, Mr. Case.
It's over on Moss Avenue.
I couldn't buy a house if it was nothing down and cheaper than rent.
Those would be the terms.
I beg your pardon.
Nothing down and $30 a month, or $3,000 in cash when you get it.
You really mean it?
Well, I figure anybody who'd make good on a cement pipe for me will make good on his own home.
It's on Moss Avenue?
Solid construction. There's a pump in the kitchen, so Evelyn won't have to go outside for water. And an acre of land, a good barn, and only half a mile from the end of the car line.
Oh, it sounds too good to pass up.
Another thing, Bob. You're starting to invent more things than you realize. It's time you got some of those ideas patented. I can help you. Remember, I am a lawyer.
My first earth-moving invention was the gondola, named after the railroad gondolas used to move coal and gravel. Scrapers up to then had used air pressure, and they were heavy monsters. You hit a rock and you'd probably break an air hose, and you never could scrape very evenly. My idea was to weld the thing together, which meant less weight, and to make it wider so we could scrape more. But the big innovation was to use electric motors, welded right onto the blades to move the gears to change the angle. One operator could do the whole thing, and the job you did in leveling was smooth as a tabletop. Another thing that bothered me was how to move more cubic yards of dirt, since we had the power to pull it once it was scraped up. One day, I thought of the answer. You remember those collapsible aluminum cups? Collapsible buckets. I could move 6 cubic yards with a gondola. With my new idea, I'd fill one bucket, pull a lever and expand it by another overlapping bucket, and double my capacity. Later, I'd add extra buckets to move 16 tons and more of dirt at a time. That unit became known as the Mountain Mover, and I guess it set the pace for earth-moving equipment around the world. Yes, Evelyn.
Bob. Oh, Bob, something wonderful has happened.
Oh, now, we've got Louise and Donald. You're not trying to tell me...
Oh, silly. My father's here.
He is? Mr. Peterson, have you been here long?
You might say I've been waiting 7 long years.
Well, I didn't mean that, sir.
Bob, I've been an unforgiving man long enough. 7 years is long enough.
Oh, Dad.
Bob, I just came by, finally, to tell you that I think you're all right. My daughter is all right. And my grandchildren are all right. Maybe we can start all over again.
So we conclude Chapter 5 of Mover of Men and Mountains, the story of R.G. Letourneau. This is another in the series, Stories of Great Christians, produced by the Department of Broadcasting of the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago. Stories of Great Christians. From the Department of Broadcasting of the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago, we bring you Chapter 6 of Mover of Men and Mountains, the story of Robert Gilmore Letourneau. In 1926, my family and my business were growing. Evelyn and I now had 3 children, Louise, Donald, and Richard. Counting Caleb, who died in infancy, eventually we'd have a family of 6 boys and a girl. I always have said that Mom, that's Evelyn, specializes in boys. As for the business, well, it was 5 years before I realized that I really was in business. We had an acre of land at 112 Moss Avenue in Stockton, California, Gradually, the yard started to fill up with steel and cable and machinery. I didn't start out planning to be a manufacturer. I started out as a contractor who needed specialized equipment. So I invented and made my own, or modified what I could buy. I hired my crews to build the highways or railroad yards or whatever else we had won a contract for. And then, during slack seasons, used these same men to build new machines or repair the old ones. In this process, I suddenly realized that I had sold a welding outfit and a scraper to one of my biggest competitors. That was the beginning. Although for several years to come, I really thought my major occupation was that of contractor.
You'll return, all right.
They told me you were a big man.
Mr. Kaiser, it's a pleasure.
Call me Henry. How old are you?
Well, 38.
I'm only 44. Quit school when I was 13. Understand you quit when you were 14. So there's no need to stand on ceremony. I'll call you Bob.
Yes, sir.
Henry.
Henry?
I sure like what I see around here. These machines you have aren't toys or flukes. They're the means to make big jobs smaller. I want to buy this mountain mover. In fact, I want to buy three of them. Exactly what I need for a job we're doing in the High Sierras.
I heard you're building a dam up there.
Yeah, the only way I can shave time on my contract is to have your machines. Better yet, Bob, I'll buy your patents and build the machines myself. I'll give you $50,000 for your patents on the mountain mover. What's more, I'll buy the machines that make the mountain mover. And I'll contract with you to build me a new factory to build them in Oakland. You set the price. I'll trust you. And I think we can do business. Now, Bob, are you the kind of person who needs a week to think things over? Or do you recognize a good deal right off the bat? What'll it be?
Henry Kaiser was a non-stop individual if I ever saw one. I didn't have to think long about his offer. Anything I made was for sale. And considering that I got the idea for those telescoping buckets from a 10-cent collapsible aluminum cup, the price Kaiser offered was mighty attractive. That began a long and sometimes stormy association. I learned a lot from him, how to organize myself and my job, how to take full responsibility when things went wrong. The example, I sold him three hoppers, a new invention, for a job in Mississippi. Although I told Henry I didn't think they'd work in the mud, sure enough, they didn't. And I got a telephone call asking me to rush down and fix things up. Well, I had other things on my mind and, in effect, told Henry, I told you so. An hour later, I realized I hadn't been a very good Christian in that situation and phoned back to say I was on the way. I didn't get to speak to Henry.
Mr. Kaiser says don't bother. We're figuring it out from here, and where we'll buy our next machines.
I apologized to Henry later and had a chance to help him out on a couple of other jobs. Meanwhile, we had developed a cable-controlled scraper half the size of the mountain mover, but twice as fast, and a machine that could move 20 tons of dirt at a time. The patents I'd sold Henry a few years before were still useful, but they were now obsolete.
Bob, you better slow down.
Oh, sorry, Evelyn. Thanks.
You're glad to be going back to Stockton.
Well, I'm not that wild about Los Angeles, but I did enjoy being in the Bible school.
Oh, Bob, I don't think you enjoyed it.
I learned a lot. You certainly did. And it'll probably help you more than me, seeing as you do so much Bible teaching.
Mm, it was a wonderful 3 months. Oh, poor Bob.
Well, not all that poor. We could afford to take a 3-month leave of absence.
Oh, you know what I mean. You're just not cut out for the classroom.
You're right. I'm cut out to be on a job out of doors, or stay behind a drafting table, or work with my big toys.
Mm, at all hours.
Hey, I'll be glad to see Louise and the boys.
Oh, and I imagine their grandparents will be glad to see us.
People sometimes ask me if I only employ Christians. My answer is no. I attracted a lot of Christians to my jobs, and I was glad to have them because I believe Christians can work rings around any roughneck. But I like to have a few roughnecks around for the believers to work on. We don't work on Sundays, though, with a very few emergency exceptions, I've found that aside from the spiritual benefits, the Roughnecks won't blow everything on Saturday night if they don't have to work on Sunday. I guess working the big machines gave the men a sense of dignity and a respect that they hadn't enjoyed before. They weren't common laborers. They weren't mule skinners anymore. They were technicians, and morale was high. I will say this, though. Working with Christians doesn't necessarily mean that you won't have any problems. An experience I would just as soon forget was the time we were working on the Newhall Highway cutoff near Bakersfield. My partner was a member of my church, and we had formed the L&L Company for this one job.
Bob, why aren't you out there on that cut? This job will never get done with you sitting behind that desk.
Well, now, Mac, you know I spend very little time behind this desk. What's the problem?
We're losing our shirts on this job. That's the problem.
Look, the test holes looked good, but there's just more clay and shale than we counted on. The rooters are breaking it up. We've got to use the power shovels and the big hoppers, and that takes more time and more money.
Well, the way things are going, we're going to lose $100,000 in this job.
Well, I hope you're wrong, but you could be right.
I just can't afford that kind of loss.
No, neither can I, Mac. Now, something else is bothering you. I'm sure of it. Now, what is it?
All right, I'll come right out with it. I'll tell you what's really wrong with this job. You've got too many relatives working on it.
Well, you may have me there. Let's see. There's my brother Louis and my wife.
Louis's okay. He's the only one who knows how to keep books.
And I have three brothers-in-law. We better include Jack and Joe Salvador, too, because they're practically members of the family. You think that's too many relatives?
Yes.
Well, why, Mac? Aren't they doing their job?
They're bad for morale.
Well, Mac, I've always been of the opinion that there's no harm in hiring relatives as long as they work twice as hard as anyone else. And another thing, the way our money situation is getting, relatives will go without a salary a lot longer than anyone else. Mac, if you have qualified relatives, I'll be glad to hire them.
That's not what I had in mind.
Well, what do you suggest I do?
Fire them. All except Louis.
Oh, Mac, you don't make things easy for me. Maybe both of us should pray about it.
The next day, I heard about a possible contract with the Southern Pacific near San Francisco. My bid was accepted, and I packed the relatives off to show what they could do, all of them except Louis. I commuted back and forth on the overnight trains to check on both jobs. Meanwhile, back in Bakersfield, one of our power shovels stalled at the entrance to the cut and simply couldn't proceed. It stopped the traffic and warning lights were put out. It was 2 o'clock in the morning. I was in my tent when I heard the rumble, and I thought I was back in the San Francisco quake. One whole side of the mountain had fallen in. And my first thought was for my crew. But miraculously, every person was accounted for. There was no loss of life. What happened was that we had cut down to 180 feet, cutting through a level of oil shale. The great mass of earth and stone on the west wall simply slid away on that greasy bed of stone. It was a time for great rejoicing and thanksgiving. Mac, don't you realize what this means? We don't have any more digging to do. All we have to do is haul it away. We won't lose money on this job. We'll break even and may even make a few dollars.
I understand you made a pretty fair profit on that San Francisco job.
Well, I really don't see what that has to do with this job.
You sent part of our crew up there.
Well, I shipped my relatives to whom you objected, and if I may say so, they proved themselves quite well.
We are partners, aren't we?
Not on that leveling job. I bid on that one myself.
But you did spend a lot of time up there. It did affect progress here, and I think we should split that profit 50-50.
You're not serious.
I most certainly am.
Well, you don't have a leg to stand on, Mac. It's so obvious.
I'll sue if I have to.
You'd go to court over this?
I would.
Oh, Mac, I guess I'd like to see you sue me. Because I think you'd lose. And I'm angry enough right now to want to see that. But that wouldn't be right. This isn't any way for two Christians to act.
Just split everything 50-50 and I'll be satisfied. 50-50 on both jobs.
I really don't have to, Mac. But I'll do it. Because I don't want to cause a scandal in our church or in our community. But you know, this kind of 50-50 partnership reminds me of the cook who made 50-50 rabbit stew. One horse and one rabbit. Sort of one-sided. No hard feelings.
Is everybody here? Let's try to get this in. Well, I think I believe we're all here and can proceed. This is an exciting day, Bob.
It sure is, Mr. Case.
3 weeks ago, on October 30th, the stock market collapsed and the economic future of this country seemed to be in doubt.
Except here in Stockton.
Right. Because today, November 19th, 1929, we meet together to sign the Articles of Incorporation of R.G. Letourneau Incorporated. Hey! Evelyn, would you read the first of the two purposes of this corporation?
To engage in the business of constructing streets, roads, highways, railroads, dams, waterways, and all other structures and improvements of every kind in nature upon public or private property.
And Bob?
To invent, design, plan, construct, manufacture, operate, sell, otherwise deal in machinery, tools, and implements of every kind in nature.
On paper, we were worth 1,000 shares at $100 each, plus $27,000 in factory, tools, and inventory. It was another milestone in trying to become God's businessman. By accepting God as your partner, no limit can be placed on what can be achieved. But God is no remote partner, satisfied if you go to church on Sunday and drop some religious money, the small change that goes to church on the platter. He isn't overwhelmed if you read the Bible once in a while and obey the golden rule. That isn't active Christianity, just a half-hearted way of getting along. When you go into partnership with God, you've got a partner closer and more active than any human partner you can ever get. He participates fully in everything you let him do. And when you start putting on airs and thinking you're doing it with your own head of steam, he can set you down quicker and harder than a thunderbolt. Say, do I know that? There's nothing dull about being in partnership with God. And so we conclude Chapter 6 of Mover of Men and Mountains, the story of R.G. Letourneau. This is another in the series, Stories of Great Christians, produced by the Department of Broadcasting of the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago. Stories of Great Christians. From the Department of Broadcasting of the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago, we bring you Chapter 7 of Mover of Men and Mountains, the story of Robert Gilmore Letourneau. One of the sayings I've become known for is this one. Not how much of my money do I give to God, but how much of God's money do I keep for myself? It wasn't always that way. We incorporated our company in 1929, 3 weeks after the crash. We didn't seem to know that there was supposed to be a depression. So we built a second factory in Stockton over by Roosevelt Avenue and Wilson Way. 1930, our sales totaled more than $110,000, and there was a net profit of nearly $35,000. And as best as I can recollect, I got down on my knees at the end of that year and prayed something like this. Lord, I want to thank you for your bounty. I want to thank you for sparing us from the business depression that's sweeping the country. Now, Lord, now that the new factory is finished, we'll really do some business. So instead of giving you your share now, I'll put it into expanding the business. And next year, Lord, you'll get a share to be proud of. Well, if I live to be 1,000 years old, I'll never forget the two lessons I soon had to learn. Lesson number one, well, the learning took place near Boulder Dam, or Hoover Dam, if you prefer, not far from Las Vegas. The government had started work on the dam in 1928, but there still wasn't any dam. There wasn't even a road. That was what I was supposed to build.
Get that rig over here. Come on.
Hey, turn that. Hey, come on, bring that thing up. Let's come.
That's it.
We're getting farther and farther behind schedule, Bob.
I know that, Howard. Keep drilling. What happened? Looked like you were making some progress.
Look at that rock, Bob. Nothing. Just wearing out the bit.
How could the engineers mess us up this way? The test holes all look good. Soft, crumbly rock. Said. Made my bid accordingly.
Well, they sure missed this heavy buried rock. What do we do?
I'm thinking. Thinking about Kaiser and those other guys who need this road so they can get that equipment up country to build the dam. Wait a minute. Do you see that stratum of yellow rock over there?
Yeah. Never noticed it before.
That's relatively soft rock. I've worked it before. Why not drill a tunnel?
Coyote hole? I just don't know.
It's the one thing we haven't tried. Drill it long, as far as we can go. Fill her with dynamite. It ought to move some rock.
You're serious?
I'm serious.
Even with power drills, digging that tunnel was hard work. The men worked in 2-hour shifts, and I think I suffered as much as they did. The noise in the tunnel was deafening. That tunnel progressed only by inches. But one day, the big day, we were ready with the dynamite, and we didn't skimp.
Ready?
Ready! We're back in business! Did I say we were back in business? Well, the rocky barrier was broken. All we had to do now was haul it off. If you drive from Boulder City to what again is called Hoover Dam, you'll drive over that road we built. You'll see the crumbly stone where we drilled our nice little test holes. You'll see some of the hardest, blackest rock you'll ever see, rising almost vertically. I finished the road on schedule, but at a financial loss I'd rather not remember. I owed $50,000 to my suppliers, another $50,000 for the steel used in my factories. Now, wasn't that the way to see that the Lord got his share? Well, that was lesson number one. Now, for lesson number two, Orange County, California, just south of Los Angeles, where I contracted to build the world's largest earth-filled dam. Oh, I'm sorry. Who are you?
I'm the state inspector of dams, Mr. Letourneau.
Glad to see you, but nothing to inspect yet. We're just bringing in the equipment and getting settled.
I know, and that's why I'm here. I'm sorry, but you'll have to wait until next year.
What? It's only July.
You should have started with your preliminary work 2 months ago. If you start now, you'll only be half through when the fall rains begin.
your spillways won't be finished, and you'll lose a lot of water and a lot of people would be hurt.
Inspector, I appreciate the situation. I really do, but you haven't seen my machines in action, how fast they can move dirt. And my men are experts, the best in the business. At least, give us a chance to show what we can do.
All right. You have to move in 400,000 cubic yards of fill for the base of that dam. Now, that won't back up much water, so I can let you move that much in. But you'll have to move it in 1 month. Now, if you can do that, then I'll know you can finish the job on time.
1 month to move 400,000 cubic yards.
If you can't move that much in a month, the work stops right there.
I couldn't let the work stop right there. If we had to wait until next year to complete this job, there wouldn't be an R.G. Letourneau Incorporated to do it. We were in serious financial difficulty, and I already had a representative from my creditors and surety company in San Francisco looking over my shoulder. So we went to work, 7 days a week. Yes, including Sundays, around the clock. Using every ditch digger, scraper, hopper, bulldozer, sheepfoot roller I could find. Plus, a 1.25-mile long conveyor belt to move the dirt faster. Quite an innovation for 1931.
Well, I really didn't think you could do it.
With an extra day to spare.
I didn't think you could do it either.
This is Smith from San Francisco. He represents the surety company. He's worse than a state inspector of dams.
You have quite a sense of humor, Mr. Letourneau.
Well, I'm not laughing. I mean it.
That's a new record, isn't it? 400,000 cubic yards in 1 month?
I wouldn't have mentioned this a month ago, but the best we ever did. Most dirt we ever moved before in 1 month was only 200,000 cubic yards.
Well, you've proved what you can do. Go ahead and finish the job this year.
Just goes to show what you can do when you work 7 days a week.
I beg your pardon?
Working 7 days a week, including Sundays.
We're not going to continue that practice.
But you are. You owe too much on that Boulder fiasco. The more you work, the faster you'll get the job done. And maybe there'll be a bit more profit with which to pay off your bills.
Well, I've worked 4 straight Sundays. I've never done that before in my life, and I don't like it. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. That's the way I grew up, and that's the way I've worked, and the way I've worked my men.
That's impractical foolishness. We're going to stay ahead on this job by working on Sundays. Or else we'll foreclose and take over the job ourselves. I think I'll have Mr. Hall telephone you. After all, he is the boss, now.
No, Mr. Smith. He isn't the boss, not yet. He may own the surety company in San Francisco, but he doesn't own me. And he won't.
Mr. R.G.?
Come in. Oh, Harry. You're up late. Come over and sit down. Coffee?
No, not that brew you make. No, sir.
What's the matter with it? I just keep adding water and another teaspoon of coffee every day.
Well, that coffee sure has a reputation.
Okay, Harry. What's on your mind?
Some of us have been talking. We like working for you, and we don't want to see it go under. So we found out about this factory going out of business and selling its tools. We can get $50,000 worth for only $5,000.
What kind of tools?
Well, drills, lathes, welding equipment, the works. We could build scrapers with them.
Oh, we might not have a factory. No roof over our heads.
Then you'll find us an open field someplace.
I'm very much touched by what you men want to do. Perhaps it won't come to that. Harry, do me this favor. Thank all of the men who want to buy the tools. Tell them to wait. And tell them we won't be working on Sundays anymore. Yes?
Letourneau?
Yes?
Mrs. Hall, San Francisco?
Yes, sir.
Did you get our check?
Yes, $30,000 for the payroll.
Have you cashed it?
No, sir.
Don't.
And don't do anything till I get down there, because I'm taking over.
You've been doing a good job down here, Letourneau. Amazing.
I didn't expect Smith to make that kind of report.
Smith was mostly upset about you not working on Sundays.
I know.
I sent him packing. I think he was a bad influence.
And you'll be staying?
Yeah. Taking over?
Yes.
No. You know, I don't know why, Bob, but I had a change of heart about that. I thought a lot about it coming down on the train.
And the Lord's answered my prayer.
Yeah, I think he did. You know, we still got a problem. The banks do want to foreclose. Right now, we only pay 10 cents on the dollar.
Well, I've got some new ideas for machinery. I've learned a lot at Boulder and here in Orange County.
That's what I told him in San Francisco. Why settle for 10 cents on the dollar when, if you stick with Bob Letourneau, you get the whole dollar? They'll go along with one condition.
Well, I don't like conditions.
Now, you don't have much choice, Bob. They want to appoint an accountant to keep track of your books.
Well, now, just a minute.
Now, you hold on. You hold on just a minute. You need a cost accounting system, Bob. You're a big boy. You need time studies. You're charging too much for some things and too little for others. A good accountant will help you, Bob, and that is the condition.
No work on Sunday?
Well, not if that's the way you feel about it.
All right.
Bob, you're all right. Now, you go ahead and cash that check.
Bob, Mr. Case says he wants to see you.
Oh, Evelyn, I've had about my fill of bankers.
I know what he wants to talk to you about, and, well, I think I agree with him.
Okay, what is it?
Well, he says you have to decide between being a contractor or a manufacturer. And he says to keep in mind that when you lose money in contracting, it's usually the factory that bails you out.
And he thinks I should be building machines instead of roads.
Yes.
And you agree?
Yes.
Well, so do I. Evelyn, I don't enjoy staying in trailers that much. Not anymore. And my head is just buzzing with new ideas that I'd like to try out on these engineers here at the plant. But most important, it's time that I worked harder at being a father and a businessman.
Oh, I won't object.
And as for that businessman part of it, I finally figured out how to keep up with our pledge at the church. I'm going to put the pledge on the payroll. Just pay it out regular. That way, we won't get behind. We'll just tell the Lord, help yourself. So we conclude Chapter 7 of Mover of Men and Mountains, the story of R.G. Letourneau. This is another in the series of Stories of Great Christians, produced by the Department of Broadcasting of the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago. Stories of Great Christians. From the Department of Broadcasting of the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago, we bring you Chapter 8 of Mover of Men and Mountains, the story of Robert Gilmore Letourneau. We struggled through the Depression years. Struggled is the right word, I think. And most everybody who lived through those days knows what I mean. We were building construction equipment, and I continued to be a contractor, finally discovering that even in this area of life, I could not serve two masters. That's when R.G. Letourneau Incorporated decided to do only manufacturing. 1930 was the year we made some $34,000. I decided to withhold the Lord's share until the following year, plowing back all of the profits I could into the new business. Well,
A year later, in 1931, after a near construction disaster near Boulder Dam, we wound up the year with a loss, not a profit, of some $32,000. I had enough sense to realize that something was wrong. And most likely it was because I wasn't putting the Lord first. I won't bore you with a profit and loss statement, but just let me say this. Within 5 years, our sales topped the $2 million mark.
Bob, are you still working?
Yes, Evelyn.
Oh, Bob, you'll be late for your meeting at the mission.
Meeting? Tonight?
Bob, you forgot.
Evelyn, I can't go tonight. I've got to work out this problem. It's very important. And I seem to be so close to figuring it out.
Looks like a series of pulleys.
Well, I'd like to call it a power control unit. You see, there really ought to be an easier way to lead the cable off into any direction. We can't do that now.
Oh, and you've been at it all day.
Maybe. Working at it another hour or so, I
can... Bob?
Okay, Evelyn. First things first. I keep forgetting. Nothing much I can do down at the mission tonight except just be there and talk to somebody, but I'll go. And I'm not going because I have to, but because I want to. It was a strange experience. It was young people's night, and I always enjoyed their singing. I had to introduce the speaker. And after that, I just sort of sat there, letting what was happening to me happen. I didn't seem particularly needed, but that didn't particularly bother me. The Lord was there. His Spirit was working. And being there was the right thing at the right time and place for me. It was midnight when I got home, but I wasn't sleepy. I went back to my drafting board and started to doodle with my pencil. I then had the urge to draw, and it turned out to be a strange drawing. A tangle of sheaves and cables, sheaves pivoting this way and that, the cables weaving through them. I spent the rest of the night developing the plans in detail, and my engineers went to work on them in the morning. During my lifetime, I've been granted more than 300 different patents. Only Thomas Edison has more. But the invention that came to me that night may have been the most important of them all. What it was a cable-controlled system by which scraper bucket, scraper iron, and powered tailgate could all be operated smoothly, regardless of how the tractor, with its cable winches, might twist or turn tight corners or wrench itself up one side of a gully while the scraper was still coming down the other side. I know that sounds complicated, but this became the heart of our new carry-all scraper and the heart of every major piece of earth-moving equipment made today, no matter who makes it.
Bob, you're sure you want to go ahead with this move?
I am, Mr. Case. Are those the papers there?
Yes, sir. Everything's in order. The Caterpillar tractor people will provide you with a sales organization, and I guess you'll be building your plant next to theirs in Peoria, Illinois. You got your land purchased?
23 acres on the Illinois River. It's old circus land.
I hope it won't flood. Being on the river like that...
Aren't we in the earth-moving business? Shouldn't we be able to contour that land so that we'll have our own flood control?
I guess so, Bob, and you probably will.
You might say that I built the harness and the cart, and Caterpillar built the horse. You see, back in the mid-30s, I didn't build tractors. Holt and Best, which later formed the Caterpillar Company, did that. I built scrapers and hoppers and all kinds of accessories, the earth movers. And moving to Peoria was good, because we could ship whatever contractors ordered together on the same flat car. We built the factory as we built our machines, welding frame and sides and roof together, which was something new, and which was sturdier and less expensive.
Hey, Pat, do you know what RG stands for in Mr. Letourneau's name?
No idea.
And you haven't seen some of his weird designs. RG stands for Rube Goldberg.
You're going to the shop meeting.
I don't have to go, you know.
But it's a pretty good deal. Go to the shop meeting and get paid for it, or just go back to the shop and work.
I didn't start off having a factory chaplain. That came later. But early on, I'd have preachers and evangelists and missionaries come by to speak to the men. It was another way to bear witness to Jesus Christ. Which reminds me of something else. One day, I was asked to speak to the Peoria Chamber of Commerce. The whole idea of standing up in front of a lot of people just terrified me. I quietly asked the Lord to calm me down and help me. Then I wondered if I shouldn't say something along spiritual lines instead of just business. I'm glad to be in a city with so many fine churches and so many Christians who love the same Lord I do. You know, our forefathers came to America seeking freedom to worship God. They put on our coins the words, "In God we trust." Now I know it was our forefathers' faith in God that made our country great. I believe we need to get back to that faith. And when we do, God will lead us out of the depression we've been in. We know as businessmen that when we have a product that won't work, it won't sell, and we hunt around until we get a product that will work and will sell. Now I ask you, what's the use of having a religion that won't work? If I had a religion that limped along during the week, maybe worked only on Sunday or while you're in church, I don't think I'd be very sold on it. I think I'd turn it on to a new model that worked 7 days a week. It would work when I was at church, in my home, or out at the plant. And that, my friends, is what Christianity is. What it does. It works. It isn't just talk and no production. I believe in Christianity because I've seen it work.
Who was that, dear?
Another local pastor wants me to speak at his church. Evelyn, I'm no speaker.
If the Lord is opening doors, Bob, don't try to close them. Besides, I think you're a fine speaker.
Can you take time to talk?
Of course, Bob.
Well, it's about this partnership we have with God. If we have a good year, we give him a tithe as his share. In the old days, it was forced on people. Now it's voluntary, and we're not doing much more. Not a bit more than people in those olden days.
Mm-hmm. But what is on your mind, Bob?
I'd like to set up a foundation. A foundation dedicated to God. We could give half the stock in the company to the foundation and keep half for ourselves.
Well,
what?
Well, it sounds fine, but the company is getting so big. Pretty soon it'll do all the work, if you know what I mean.
You mean, if we only share the company profits, it won't be personal?
Mm-hmm. Something like that.
Okay. We'll give half the company profits to the foundation and half of our own income to keep it personal.
Oh, that still leaves an awful lot. Your brother Bill says we may make $500,000 profit this year. You know, if we split that and give half of what's left... Oh, Bob.
We can always return the excess to the company for expansion. I'll tell you what. Let me call Carlton Case in California. He's still the best lawyer I know.
Good to hear your voice, Bob. What's on your mind?
I want you to set up a foundation for us. A foundation to sponsor religious, missionary, and educational work for the greater glory of God.
All right.
I don't know what the laws are, but I want you to fix it so that the funds of the foundation can never be used for company or personal purpose.
You're out of your mind. But then you always were.
Be sure you understand me. Neither I, nor Evelyn, nor the children are to be able to take back any of the stock or money given to the foundation or earned by it ever.
I understand. A perpetual and irrevocable trust.
That sounds good. Get to work on it, Mr. Case. Eventually, that foundation would own 90% of our common stock and 90% of our income. It became the largest Christian foundation of its kind. As I've mentioned before,
A guiding principle for me has been, not how much of my money do I give to the Lord, but how much of the Lord's money do I keep for myself. After all is said and done, everything belongs to Him. The business operation grew, and so did our ministry for Christ. We started a little publication called Now, with news of the company interspersed with the good news, much of this written by my brother-in-law, Tom Olson. I also found myself spending most of my weekends traveling somewhere to witness for Christ. On May 30th, 1937, Evelyn, the company mail quartet, and I were driving to Bob Jones College.
When are we going to stop for lunch?
Oh, Bill, you're always hungry.
We'll stop in Murfreesboro. It's about 12 miles ahead.
How are we doing up there, Evelyn?
Oh, I'm sitting between two fine boys. And you're a good driver, Peter.
Thank you, ma'am.
I never worry about Peter's driving. Hey, why don't we sing? There is sunshine in my soul today.
Oh, Pop, you're just going to have to invent a better way to carry a tune.
Well, I never built any airplanes, but I can still get up in the air.
Oh, I don't follow your logic.
There the sunshine, blessed sunshine, when the peaceful, happy moments roll.
Where did that car come from?
It's going pretty fast.
Peter, that driver's not watching the road.
Oh. Peter, our driver, his brother Orin, were killed instantly. So was the driver of the other car, and the two passengers he had turned around to talk to instead of watching the road. Evelyn was unconscious. My body cushioned the two boys in back, Norman Dirks and Bill Eitzen. Bill escaped almost unscratched.
Bill, ease me out, gentle. I think my hip bones are broken.
Well, now, I don't want to move you too much.
Bill, the Lord is very near right now. I want you to see that our six children go through for God. Those are my only instructions. See that the children go through for God. If Evelyn and I go to be with Jesus.
And so we conclude Chapter 8 of Mover of Men and Mountains, the story of R.G. Letourneau. This is another in the series of Stories of Great Christians produced by the Department of Broadcasting of the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago. Stories of Great Christians. From the Department of Broadcasting of the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago, we bring you Chapter 9 of Mover of Men and Mountains, the story of Robert Gilmore Letourneau. I've often remarked that there were four bankruptcies in my life. At age 16, there was a moral bankruptcy. That is when I accepted Christ as my Savior. At age 32, it was a spiritual bankruptcy. I believe that is when Christ truly became my Lord. When I was 43, it was financial bankruptcy at the height of the Depression. And now, at age 49, in 1937... it was physical bankruptcy. There had been a head-on automobile collision in Tennessee. Three people in the other car were killed, as were two members of our mail quartet. Evelyn and I survived, I believed then, as I believe now, that all things work together for good to them that love God. But to be honest with you, I did not know whether I would live or die. You're the doctor here?
Yes, sir. I'm the resident physician.
I've been waiting quite some time to see you.
We had a lot to do, sir. Are you in pain?
Yes, but what about Evelyn, my wife? How is she?
Well, sir, she got cuts and bruises from head to foot, but she has no broken bones.
That's a miracle.
Well, considering that she was in the front seat, yes, sir.
And the two boys?
Mr. Dirks has a broken arm and collarbone, and the other boy...
Bill.
Hasn't a scratch, thanks to you.
I don't understand.
Your body shielded him, cushioned him. He was the one who got the rest of you out.
I'd like to know where I stand, although that's probably the wrong word. I do have some broken bones.
Yes, sir. Apparently you braced your feet for the impact.
Yes, I remember.
And well, sir, your legs were driven into your body like battering rams. And one hip socket is shattered, and your pelvis is fractured. There are all sorts of internal injuries in the abdominal area.
Surely there's not more.
I'm afraid so. Your chest and one foot are crushed, and one leg is broken, splintered.
I am in pain, but how is it that I'm even able to speak?
Mr. Letourneau, I don't know.
You're saying I shouldn't be alive? That I'm still in danger?
Oh, yes.
Well, then, what are you going to do about it?
Do?
Yes. Aren't you going to put me back together again?
Operate?
Well, you said bones are splintered, sockets shattered. Shouldn't you do something about that? Look, if God has permitted me to survive, there must be some good reason. And surely there's something you can do to help me do more than survive, to help me to live. I guess I haven't ever had much tolerance for doctors or dentists, at least when they've had to work on me. Those guys thought I was so far gone that they didn't dare to operate, that it wouldn't make any difference, or that it would kill me. I was so mad that I forgot about my pain and the seriousness of the injuries. Perhaps God used that anger to support my will to live. Well, they did operate, and I was encased in plaster from neck to foot and taken by ambulance back to Peoria. They said I'd have to stay in the cast for 6 months, and that there was no guarantee that my shattered hip socket would ever support my weight again.
Well, you look happy today. Feeling better?
Ah, yes, dear. I wish you folks would change the cast around here once in a while, though.
Oh, it's so nice to see you laughing.
Evelyn, you know me. If you're able to do something about the situation, do it. And then don't worry about things that you can't do anything about.
Are you in pain?
My right leg hurts. It's sort of strange, considering all the other possibilities for aches and pains.
Well, what's so funny?
I just remembered an old joke. It started out just like I said. My right leg hurts. And the doctor then says, well, it's probably just old age. To which the patient replies, but my left foot is just as old. How come it doesn't hurt?
Bob, you've been drawing.
Any law against that?
But you're supposed to rest.
No, I can't turn my mind off, Evelyn. And the Lord keeps sending ideas my way.
Oh, you are impossible. Now, what's this?
That's my newest invention. It's a stretcher with wheels, so I can be taken through the factory for inspection tours.
Oh, good idea. Now, what's this?
Well, haven't finished that one yet. It's a new idea for a tractor.
But there are only two wheels. Where's the rest of it?
Now, Evelyn, I'd expect that kind of smart aleck remark from one of my engineers, but from you?
Well, I never saw such a tractor.
Correct, because no such tractor has ever been made. Look, a tractor in construction work pulls some mighty heavy equipment, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's all hitched on back here. Once it's hitched, you don't need four wheels or caterpillar tracks on a tractor. If you can cut down on the weight, you'll improve the efficiency.
Well, it's different.
Send Chester or Elmer around tomorrow. We need to bang our heads together on this one. The engineers didn't think too much of the idea either, at first.
Where's the rest of it, Archie? Is this a tractor with no front wheels or a tractor with no back wheels?
But eventually, my engineers were convinced. But the Caterpillar people, whose tractors I had consistently used, couldn't see its usefulness at all. So that's when we finally got to building our own. Road-building equipment and tractors. We began manufacturing the Turnipull in 1938. 20 years later, 8 different manufacturers featured the same design at the National Road Show. We were just a little bit ahead of the pack, and it was one of the many things of that horrible accident that worked for good. I haven't talked much about my family, have I? About our 6 children, 5 boys and 1 daughter. I didn't spend as much time with them as I should have. Evelyn took them camping and on most of the outings. I spent long hours at the plant, with my toys, as we called them, and on most weekends, I'd be traveling. I've met a lot of wonderful people in my day. Harold Strathern was a Baptist preacher who directed the Laterno Evangelistic Center. Many Christian and Missionary Alliance missionaries and pastors have helped me in my walk with the Lord. Dr. V. Raymond Edmond, who became the president of Wheaton College, R.R. Brown of Nebraska, and R.A. Forrest of Georgia. It was because of him that we built another plant at Toccoa Falls. Dr. Forrest was going overseas, and I gave him $1,000 to give away as he saw fit.
Mr. Laterno, here are the receipts.
What do you mean, receipts? Receipts for what?
You gave me $1,000. These receipts will tell you how I spent your money. Missionaries, national Christian workers, Christian bookstalls or clinics that needed some immediate help. It's all here.
You're quite an organized man.
Well, I sure hope so. And let me say, I thoroughly enjoyed being able to give your money away.
Great. I'm glad you did.
Now, if I can only get you to come up to Toccoa Falls, maybe we can induce you to give away some more.
It wasn't just philanthropy that took me to Georgia. We needed to expand, and North Georgia seemed to be the right place. Evelyn fell in love with the Toccoa Falls Bible Institute and with the area. Evelyn sort of had soft spots for conference centers all over the nation, Chautauqua, Winona Lake, where she operated Bethany Camp, and Mount Hermon in California. Well, after we moved to Georgia, soon there would be another Christian camp and conference center at Lake Louise. My son Donald was graduated from the Bible Institute, married, also felt very close to those North Georgia hills. Yes? This is he.
Who would be calling at this hour?
Will you give that to me again?
Bob, what is it? Has something happened?
Please, Evelyn. I understand. Yes. Please phone me back when you have any more information. No. Call any time. Yes. Sit down, Evelyn. There's very bad news.
It's about Donald.
That was the North Carolina State Police.
Oh, he should never have flown today.
He crashed near Canton. That paper pulp town west of Asheville.
Oh, Pop. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, I'm sorry. His poor bride of only 2 weeks.
I'm sorry too, Mom. It was just machinery parts that he was carrying. He didn't have to take them. My son. My son. I don't know why. Why? But Evelyn, I know we have a daughter and 4 other sons. We have Louise and Rich and Roy and Ted and Ben. And this family is going to be different.
Two days after Don's funeral, I was flying to Winona Lake, Indiana, for a meeting in the Billy Sunday Tabernacle. I was flying some 200,000 miles a year now. Not everyone understood or accepted that, especially after Donald's tragic death. They'll tell you that if God had meant man to fly, he would have given him wings like the birds. Now that is ridiculous. In the 3 million or so miles that I've flown, in my own planes and in commercial flights, I've been able to carry God's message to more people than I could have met in 3 lifetimes of land and sea travel. God didn't have to give us wings to fly. He gave us the mechanical genius to fly further and faster than any winged creature in his realm. And as a mechanic, that is good enough for me. I can say with a conviction based on the bones I have broken in 2 serious automobile crashes that the most dangerous parts of my travel are between airport and hotel, and then between hotel and church. Look, friend, the air is God's too, as well as the land and the sea. And his will can be done no matter where you are. Isn't that a nice thing to know? Even in the face of tragedy. Friend, you and I are never out of God's reach and love. So we conclude Chapter 9 of Mover of Men and Mountains, the story of R.G. Letourneau. This is another in the series, Stories of Great Christians, produced by the Department of Broadcasting of the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago. Stories of Great Christians. From the Department of Broadcasting of the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago, we bring you Chapter 10 of Mover of Men and Mountains, the story of Robert Gilmore Letourneau. I was 65 years old in 1953, and most everybody expected me to retire. This was the time in our American history of business that companies, big companies, began looking for ways to diversify as well as to expand. Our company seemed to be attractive to a number of firms. The best offer came from Westinghouse Air Brake Company, and when we finally signed the papers, I kept 2 plants. The ones in Vicksburg, Mississippi, and Longview, Texas. And the new company of Westinghouse Letourneau took over the plants in Peoria, Illinois, Toccoa, Georgia, and Australia. Part of the agreement was that I would not build any earth-moving equipment for a period of 5 years. I guess they thought that that was a safe limitation. For all of this, we were paid the sum of $31 million. Please keep in mind that 90% of the stock was owned by the foundation. So whatever would happen, the Lord's work would progress and prosper. I'll be telling you a bit later how I spent those first 5 years of retirement, plus a few more after that. But let me fill in a few of the gaps. Our company had a large commitment and involvement in World War II. We manufactured 155-millimeter shells. But mostly we manufactured what we normally made, earth-moving equipment. I make no apology. I've already said that I'm not a pacifist. I know many fine Christians who are, but I happen to believe that even Christians are expected to protect their loved ones when they're under attack. But, be that as it may, during World War II, we had our hands full. You know what was usually the first piece of equipment to come off the landing craft, whether in the Pacific or Anzio or Normandy? A bulldozer. And more likely than not, a Laterno bulldozer. Beaches had to be smooth for easier and safer landings. Simple roads and exits had to be made quickly.
It was an engineer's war.
That was said by none other than General Douglas MacArthur. Reflect with me for a moment. Not only was earth-moving equipment vital on the landing beaches, it was essential in clearing debris and building and rebuilding runways for aircraft, as well as for building more conventional bridges and roads and storage sites. Up until World War II, our Corps of Engineers, for the most part, used tools and techniques that have been used since the days of the Civil War. Really. After all, our civilian methods of large-scale construction didn't change until the 1930s. Up until that time, most contractors building a road used men with shovels or men driving mules. So, in this engineer's war, we had to work overtime, and we had to expand. We built a new plant in Vicksburg, right on the Mississippi River. We combined the dedication with a war bond rally and a public picnic. If you ever want to feed 10,000 people with hot tamale pie, here's Evelyn's recipe.
First, you'll need four 350-gallon pots. Then, 2,400 pounds of ground beef, 600 pounds of onions, 90 pounds of salt, 6 pounds of black pepper, 30 pounds of Spanish pepper, and 600 pounds of cornmeal.
We built a factory in Australia, not only to be able to ship needed equipment more quickly to the Pacific area, but also to assist in development plans down under, in Australia itself. We started a plant in England, too, but it was one of our failures. After the war, in 1946, we were flying over East Texas. A steel plant had been built at Dangerfield, proving that if you scratch that rusty East Texas soil deeply enough, you'll find iron. I like the wide open spaces of Texas, and I like the idea of being located next door to a steel mill, or perhaps build my own. We were flying with Mr. Estes, the publisher of the Longview newspaper.
Mr. Estes, what's that cluster of buildings down there?
Oh, that's Harmon Hospital.
A hospital?
Built during the war.
Is that in Longview?
Yes, sir. Housed 3,000 patients.
Isn't it being used now?
Mrs. Laterno, the government has closed the hospital. In fact, it's up for sale. Surplus property.
You don't say.
Of course, that wouldn't do at all for a steel mill or a factory.
But it surely would do well for a school. That technical school you've been dreaming about, Pop.
Circle those buildings down below. Let's have a closer look. For a fellow who never finished grade school, I've been very much interested in education, especially technical education. I went to a vocational school in San Francisco, took correspondence courses in engineering. I read a lot. A fellow once told me, anybody who can read has all it takes to study. One magazine I always read from cover to cover was Iron Age. I taught my men new skills in welding. We had a regular night school going in Peoria. We made skilled workers out of unskilled mountain people in Georgia. We trained thousands of servicemen during the war to master the heavy equipment we were shipping, using films and audio visuals, which were a novelty in those days. But I had always dreamed of a technical school. And in 1946, the old Harmon Hospital became the Letourneau Technical Institute. Today, it's a fully accredited school, Letourneau College. And my son, Rich, who got all of his education, including his Ph.D. in industrial engineering and management, at his own expense, is now the president.
Well, the inventory is finished.
That must have been a job.
Job? Do you know there are 232 buildings in this campus? We've also counted stoves, refrigerators, and beds.
There ought to be a place for us to live here on campus.
Oh, I've already picked out the place. It'll do just fine.
We lived right on campus for 6 years, living and working with the students. That was the philosophy. That's what I tried to say at the very beginning on the first day of school. To raise their earning power, people must be taught. To teach them, they must have both the practical and the theoretical. To give them the practical, they must have the machines of production on which to practice. For the theoretical, they must have the classrooms, and they must have housing for both. I was driving along in my little Beetle one day, inspecting, planning, thinking. I seem to get my best ideas when I'm moving. I've taken a lot of ribbing about driving that little BW, but I liked it. You could drive it anywhere. As I was bouncing along across a field, I saw one of my big turnipoles lugging a carryall, sitting there on the testing ground with no driver to be seen. What was worse, the tractor's diesel was running. Hey! Hey, what's everybody doing? Hey, what's going on? Stop! Oh, no! He's running over my car!
Mr. R.G., are you all right? I didn't see you.
I didn't see you either. That's what had me worried.
Oh, I'm sorry about the car.
Well, so am I. And I'm glad I wasn't inside the car. I don't like to see waste. I thought someone had left an engine running and had gone off and forgotten it. That's a quick way to lose money. Some folks have the mistaken notion that it's sinful to make money, or that there's something unchristian about a Christian trying to make a profit. Well, let me tell you, I wouldn't have been a very good steward, I wouldn't have done very well by my partner, if I'd followed that philosophy. You remember that in selling our company to Westinghouse, we weren't to build or design any earth-moving equipment for 5 years. Well, we didn't. But we were sure busy, like experimenting with a missionary self-help project in Liberia. We hauled the equipment we needed on our own ship. My daughter Louise and her husband Gus were in charge. The government leased us a 500,000 acres. We built a model village, which included a school, a clinic, and a church. We introduced new methods of clearing the jungle, to retrieve valuable hardwoods, as well as to provide new fertile land for agriculture. We taught the Liberians to help themselves, teaching them how to use some of this equipment for their own development. A year later, we were carrying out a similar project in the jungles of Peru, in cooperation with a group of Wycliffe translators. My son Roy ran that one. The objective there was to provide new land for farming, clearing the jungle, keeping the jungle from coming back in. We invented some new machines in the process, giant tree saws, cutting trees flush at the ground, a jungle crusher that could clear an acre of forest in 15 minutes, new types of rooters that would chop and mulch up the jungle floor to prepare soil for gardens and farms, the log stackers and cranes. That's how we tried to share the gospel in practical ways. Our two factories were busy, but we weren't building earth-moving equipment. After the 5 years were up, however, after 1958, we started to do that again, too.
Pop, if God grants you another 10 years, what would you still like to invent?
Well, I know what I'd like to explore. I think we can make the earth movers bigger and more efficient. Maybe we should be doing more with huge conveyor belts.
What else?
Turbine engines. Now, those are the things I'd like to get into.
Oh, Pop, when are you going to retire?
Mom, when are you going to quit cooking? God has given me more ideas since I retired than I had had time to work out. So why stop? When all is said and done, I guess there are really two things I like to do. One is to design machinery, turn on the power, and see it work. The other is to tell people about the power of the gospel and see it work in their lives. Try it. God bless you. Amen. You've just heard the 10th and concluding chapter of Mover of Men and Mountains, based on the autobiography of R.G. Letourneau, published by Moody Press. Walter Carlson was heard in the role of Mr. Letourneau. Others in the cast were Mary Seibel as Evelyn Letourneau and Rex Brenner as Caleb. Others heard were Larry Moran and Hugo Reisner. Sound was by John McComb. Musical effects by Lucille Becker. Stereo sound mixer, David McAllister. The story was written by John Gillies and was directed by Mike Kellogg and is another in the series Stories of Great Christians, produced by the Department of Broadcasting of the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago.